Autumn Shadows in August, a novel by Robert W. Norris. Read by Robert W. Norris. Copyright 2006, Robert W. Norris. In the Amazon and other places where visionary plants are understood and used, you are conveyed into worlds that are appallingly different from ordinary reality. Their vividness cannot be stressed enough. They are more real than real, and that's something that you sense intuitively. They establish an ontological priority. They are more real than real, and once you get that under your belt and let it rattle around in your mind, then the compass of your life begins to spin, and you realize that you are not looking in on the other. The other is looking in on you. Terence McKenna. And now I saw as clearly as in a picture what an illusion my former personality had been. Harry Haller in Hermann Hesse's Steppenwolf. Prologue. Trapped in a flying metal coffin and gripped by a powerful sense of hurling through space and plunging earthward, of imminent death, of poignant regret for past sins, for all the things left unsaid and undone, I peer through frightened eyes at the rigid figures of the other passengers, then fix my gaze on Kaori, who is looking out the window at the rush and swirl of the clouds and sky outside. I want to reach out to comfort her, to apologize for dragging her along on this suicide journey, to tell her I love her and these are final moments together, but my mouth and body are frozen, and all I can do in our death descent is wallow in the sordid imagery of those unheeded premonitions prior to and after boarding the plane in Japan. There was that big bold headline, Sudden Death of Jackie Sato, we saw in the newspaper at the Fukuoka Airport coffee shop, and the front page story about the famous Japanese pro wrestler who had succumbed to stomach cancer at the age of 41. The similarity to Kaori's age and situation made my head spin. Then there was the sign above the gate leading to the on-ramp at the Taipei Airport Transit Terminal, where we'd changed planes, and again, in bold lettering, our plane's departure time and gate numbers slammed into my head. 13:13 at gate 13. Then, several hours later, in the plane, when I asked Kaori what the name of the hotel we'd be staying at in Amsterdam was, she answered nonchalantly, "The Terminus Hotel." And that took my breath away because, although terminus is applied to the name of the hotel, probably meant top, head, ultimate, or even objective, the other symbols of the last few hours had already taken control of my brain, and I could only make the association with terminal, and all of that word's implications of disease, finality, and death. I feel a tap on my shoulder and look around to see Thomas Knorr standing in the aisle. He's dressed in a pilot's outfit and is as handsome as he was 22 years ago. He cocks his head slightly, smiles, and says, "It's a pity, isn't it, you're coming all this way to see me and now this?" But no time to respond because the plane is in a nosedive. Kaori is facing me now, eyes wide open, mouth agape, pure panic engraved on her face. Chapter 1. I woke with a start, forehead sweating, pulse beating rapidly. I rolled slowly and stiffly to the side of the unfamiliar bed, sat upright, and wondered for a moment where I was. I wiped the sweat off my forehead and shook my head to get rid of the lingering images. My eyes gradually grew accustomed to the darkness of the Amsterdam hotel room. Kaori was sleeping soundly in the twin bed next to mine. I pushed myself off the bed, steadied myself for a moment to get some blood rushing through my ankles and knees, and shuffled to the toilet. The clock on the table at the side of the bed said 3:30. I returned to the table, sat down, and took a drink from the bottle of water I'd left there. I picked up the half-smoked joint in the ashtray, lit it, took 3 quick hits, put the roach out, and leaned back in the chair. "I can't believe I'm actually back again," I thought. It had been 26 years since my 1973 journey, when Amsterdam, Florence, Corfu, Madrid, the apocalyptic visions of Bosch's canvases in the Prado, and all of Europe's art and history stirred me. In 22 years since that 1977 life-changing adventure that started on European soil. That was the journey on which I'd met Hassan and Atola in Paris and gone with them to Lorac to meet Thomas Cunor, who, as the years passed, became in my mind a kind of guiding angel who helped prepare me for my descent into the inferno of Iran, Afghanistan, India, and all my Asian revelations. Those were followed by the many roads still later to be traveled that eventually led me to Japan and Kaori, the one person in a lifetime of rambling and searching who had managed to tame my wandering spirit and convince me to slow down my death march, focus my energies, and share my life and thoughts and eccentricities with someone, something, other than the eternal lonesome road of the nomad. I watched Kaori sleep for a while. I wanted to show her the paths I'd trod, the places that had influenced me. I wanted her to see clearly with her own eyes those parts of the past that had prodded me in her direction. I felt that by returning to the past, we could find a new start in life. This was particularly important after all the bad luck we'd had the past couple of years. First, she'd come down with stomach pains and gone to an internist, who had her swallow a stomach camera, found an ulcer, and took a biopsy. A few days later, the lab report came back. Cancer. We were devastated. Within a week, she was in the hospital preparing for surgery to cut out 2/3 of her stomach. The depth of depression she fell into over the next few months of recovery was unlike anything I'd ever seen or experienced. It was excruciating to witness. Then, just as she was pulling out of that abyss and beginning to get her strength and a grip on life back again, I found out I had hepatitis C. In fact, had probably had it for 30 years without knowing. I'd opted for 6 months of interferon treatment, and that, too, was no picnic. The side effects, those awful chills, knotted muscles and joints, sweats, paranoid thoughts, rotting nails, headaches, and overall fatigue, kicked my ass badly, but I managed to keep working the whole time. The treatment had suppressed the virus considerably, but it hadn't killed it. I didn't look forward to the next round of battling that poison. The fact was, neither of us had been a joy to live with for quite a while. This trip would be important for both of us. I took another hit off the joint. Ah, stoned again. It had been several years since the last time I smoked any pot, and God knew I needed a change of consciousness. It sure would have been nice to have while Kaori was recovering from her surgery. It would certainly have helped me in dealing with her depression. It might even have helped balance her way of looking at the world during that dark time when she'd lain in bed, staring at the walls, cursing life, and contemplating all kinds of strange ideas, from the people of Fukuoka having caused the cancer, to retiring to an isolated temple to become a monk. That period, however, was over, and anyhow, the pot might have exacerbated the depression she'd fallen into. Perhaps now, with her new upbeat approach to and appreciation for life, getting stoned might heighten that consciousness. On the plane, I'd looked forward to sharing that with her, too. I'd tried many times to explain all the details of my life and the many roads I'd traveled and how I'd come to Japan and met her, but no doubt it was hard for her to imagine me as a long-haired hippie wandering the world. In those days, marijuana, not to mention LSD, had been as much a daily part of my life as eating and sleeping. I remembered the first time I'd smoked pot. There I was, a 19-year-old kid back in 1970, struggling with the decision to declare myself a conscientious objector from within the military. I'd already received the order to fight in Vietnam, but hadn't reported to the base in Texas where I was to undergo a few weeks of intensive combat training before heading off to war. Returning to my original base and wasting time, and one day running into another airman who invited me to go for a ride, smoke some pot, and watch the sunset. That sunset was absolutely the most beautiful I'd ever seen, and the feeling I got was so light, exhilarating, comfortable, and interesting that I made the Sido decision right then and there. Even more revelatory than that first time smoking pot was the first time I took LSD a few months later in the Denver prison I was sent to. Now that was one extraordinary experience and a life filled with extraordinary experiences, but also something I wouldn't want Coyote to share with me. It was just too dangerous, knowing how she needed to have control of her mind and thoughts and emotions. It wasn't her style to probe deeply into the inner layers of her psyche to uncover what could turn into an unbearable hell. I'd seen a few people on bad trips, and it wasn't pleasant. But for me there in Denver, LSD revealed a profound cosmic humor in the world around me, and enabled me to laugh at and endure the absurdity of the circumstances I found myself in, having to meet with military psychiatrists, chaplains, doctors, prison guards, and other assorted professionals whose job was to rehabilitate the prisoners, change their thinking, break them down mentally, and mold them into model soldiers that could be sent back to the military machine. As a conscientious objector, the only one in the prison, and certainly the only political prisoner, I was unique among the 500 or so nonviolent prisoners on the base, most of them busted for drugs or being AWOL for months. I resisted the brainwashing as best I could, and in the end, when my prison time was up, I was kicked out of the service with an undesirable discharge, and I was free. Which is exactly what I'd look forward to feeling in Amsterdam, a return to that old freedom, to the time I'd wandered the earth freely, giving myself up to the wind and fate, always driven on by an overwhelming urge to experience and see everything possible because, quite frankly, I no longer cared whether I lived or died. It had been out of my hands, but beat deep down, and maybe this was the result of all the acid trips I'd taken, who knows. I'd somehow developed a faith, an inarticulate faith, devoid of religious or philosophical attachment, that all would come out right in the end, which it had, and it was my mission back then to record it all this before I landed in Japan and eventually settled into my current state of affairs as a workaholic associate professor of English at a new university. Of course, the freedom I hoped to find again in Europe would only be temporary, but it was still important I find it, if for no other reason than to reignite the fires in me that I'd lost and knew were necessary if I was to get anything out of the little time I had remaining on this planet. I got up to look out the window. Looming one street away was the high bell tower of the Oude Kerk, the old Gothic church built in the 14th century in honor of Amsterdam's patron saint, Saint Nicholas. The narrow Warmestraat below was quiet, except for two shifty black men nervously smoking hashish. Straight ahead was the Eng Kerksteeg, a short alley leading to the Oude Kerk. The street seemed to belong to drug sellers at this time of day. The two figures approached a young stroller, who ignored them and kept walking. Down the warm strut on the right were the Highlight Coffee Shop, the Budget Youth Hostel, and Stone's Cafe. On the left were more run-down businesses, the Route 66 Coffee Shop, the Hotel Croydon, and Coffee Shop Sheba. A seedy area on the edge of the red light district, and not very different from the many skid row places I'd lived in years ago when I'd wandered the streets of many American cities. I took a final toke on the roach and watched the dawn approach. The two black men took off when a truck delivering supplies to a restaurant farther up the street appeared. Coyote rose from her bed and groped her way to the toilet. I sat down on the bed and listened while she brushed her teeth. When she reemerged, a smile was on her face. "Good morning, honey-chan. How are you feeling?" "Well, my legs feel surprisingly good, but I'm stiff all over from all the walking we did yesterday and carrying our backpacks. How about you?"
"I feel rested, but stiff like you, too."
"So what do you want to do today? Where do you want to go?"
"It's Friday, so I want to go to the cheese market in Alkmaar. It opens at 10, so we need to get going soon. Then tomorrow I want to see the Van Gogh Museum." Kaori sat down next to me on the bed. "After that, you can go your way and I can go mine. I'm a tourist on this trip, and there are so many places I want to see, places I've been studying about. I guess I'm typically Japanese that way. I want to have a schedule to follow."
"Sounds good to me."
I got down on the floor and did some stretches while Kaori ate some blueberry yogurt we'd bought the day before at a market and read through her tourist guidebooks and maps.
Chapter 2. We were at Central Station by 8, buying round-trip tickets to Alkmaar. It was a 30-minute ride. We watched the flat, expansive green landscape with many trees fly by outside the train window. Canals crisscrossed the land here and there. We saw many clean, orderly brick houses. Dairy cows, sheep, and horses huddled in groups and grazed in the fields. There was a large crowd of tourists at the cheese market. Kaori took many pictures of the round 33-kilogram blocks of cheese being stacked, checked for quality, then carried to the weigh station by porters in colorful hats, who afterwards stacked them back in delivery trucks. We got separated. I rested at a cafe a while, then walked around the nearby streets taking in the sights. By the time the show was over at 12:30, the sky had turned gray. A light, cold rain began to fall. I couldn't find Kaori. The crowd thinned out, but still she was nowhere to be found. I figured she had already taken the train back to Amsterdam. I wandered down some side streets and came upon a small head shop called the Black Eagle. I entered. Reggae music on low volume filled the room. There were some displays of smoking paraphernalia and seeds in the front, a wooden table and four chairs in the back left, and a counter in the far right corner. A young, dark-eyed man with slicked back hair and wearing a silk jacket was behind the counter. He looked up and smiled at me. "Is it all right if I smoke a joint?" I asked. "I normally don't allow anyone to smoke on the premises, but you're the only customer I've had today, so I think I can make an exception. Please, sit down," the man said, motioning toward the table. I sat down, pulled out the little baggie and rolling papers I'd bought the day before, and set them on the table. "Would you like to join me?" I asked. "It's a slow day, why not?" The man brought an ashtray and put it on the table. "What are you smoking?" "It's called Red Bud. I bought it at the Siberia in Amsterdam yesterday. The lady said it gives a pleasant mellow high that's very nice for morning time when you just want to ease into the day. My name is David."
"I'm Pablo. It's nice to meet you."
We shook hands and Pablo sat down. "May I take a look?" Pablo asked.
"Go ahead."
Pablo picked up the bud, looked at it closely, then pinched it and held it to his nose. "It has a nice fragrance, but it's a little dry." He handed it back to me and said, "You should save it for later. Let's smoke some of mine. It's fresher." Pablo got up, went behind the counter, disappeared behind a curtain, and returned with a large bud and a small brass pipe. He clipped some of the bud, filled the pipe, handed it to me, and gave me a light. We took three hits apiece. "What do you think?" "It's very nice," I said. "It's not too stony, kind of refined. It tastes a bit like the Sinsemilla I used to smoke years ago." I felt quite comfortable with Pablo, almost as if I'd known him all my life. We talked for a while about places we'd traveled, adventures we'd had, and the quality of the dope we'd smoked in Nepal, Afghanistan, and Madagascar. Then we fell into private ruminations and listened to the music. I suddenly became aware of Pablo gazing intently at me. "Is something wrong?" I asked. "Not really. I just have a feeling that you're here on a special journey." "I suppose you could say that. There's a German friend who helped me years ago when I was lost and confused, and I want to see him once more and thank him." Pablo leaned forward and said, "Please, tell me about him." "His name is Thomas Knorr. He gave me a place to stay for a short while and turned me on to all kinds of things about Iran and Afghanistan in 1977, before I went to those countries. I used him as the model for one of the characters in my first novel."
"I see." Pablo took another hit off the pipe and passed it to me.
I took a good hit, held it for a moment, exhaled slowly, then continued. "We really only knew each other for about 10 days when I stayed at his place in Lorach.
I'd gone there with Hassan and Ataullah, the Iranian and Afghan I met in Paris. Anyway, those 10 days and all the adventures I had on the road from Germany to India changed my life forever, I said. In a sense, Thomas is partially responsible for leading me to Japan, to my wife and my present life. So now you expect this Thomas Knorr to give you some kind of affirmation of your life?
Pablo's question startled me. I hadn't considered it. I'm not really sure what I expect. I only know that I want to see him once more to thank him before I die, that's all.
Pablo smiled gently and raised his eyes a bit. I think there's more to it than that, he said confidently.
What do you mean?
Pablo's smile disappeared for a moment, replaced by a look of serious intent. I sense that you are here on a journey of the spirit. It's in the aura surrounding you. Pablo put the pipe and lighter on the table and leaned forward. May I speak honestly with you?
Yes, please do.
You remind me a bit of Harry Haller, whom I got to know quite well. He, like yourself, was a self-exiled member of his society, unable to integrate himself into that society. I get the feeling that you're ailing spiritually, that you're restless, astray in an alien world, unable to find contentment and fulfillment.
How can you see that? We've only just met.
A shiver ran through me. Pablo ignored my question. You had a dream recently that disturbed you, did you not?
Yes, I did, last night, in fact.
You should reflect on the symbolism that was in that dream. Dreams are a mirror into the soul and can give you profound insights into what is ailing you. Think also of the symbolism of the book you brought. Think of the symbolism in everything you encounter. Just remember that all the symbols do not necessarily pertain to you personally.
Pablo's words and what he knew about me were unsettling. It was as if he knew me better than I knew myself. I didn't know how to respond. I turned my eyes away from his for a moment and took a deep breath.
I don't know what to say. What are you, some kind of shaman or something? How can you possibly know all this about me?
Pablo leaned back in his chair and laughed softly.
No, not a shaman. You could say I'm one of life's chess players.
Chess players?
Yes. Chess is like the game of life, and the pieces of each person's game are made up of the many broken parts, the many selves of his or her personality. It is my job as a chess player to help those whose soul has broken into pieces. We do this simply by showing people like yourself that you can rearrange your own pieces in any order you want. In this way, you can build up the soul again, reclaim your artistic vision, and achieve an infinite number of moves and possibilities in your own game.
Are you inferring that I'm unstable, insane?
Perhaps. That may be your own perception or the perception of others, but what I'm saying is merely that madness is the beginning of wisdom. A wise man is one who has developed the game of his life to such an extent that he can see the humor in the pathos in the humor.
I didn't like the way the conversation was heading. I'd hated the military psychiatrist psychoanalyzing me in my prison days, and I didn't like Pablo doing it now.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean. I should probably be getting back now. The rain is letting up and...
Pablo raised his hand gently and said, "Please, wait a minute before you leave. I have something to give to you."
He got up, went into the back of his shop, and returned with a small box, which he handed to me.
"What's this?" I asked.
"You've heard of the magic theater, haven't you?"
"Yes, but I don't understand."
Pablo smiled and touched my arm. "Inside the box is a door to the theater, more of a key to a door, really. There is also a small chessboard and some pieces to play with. Use them as you see fit, or throw everything away if you will. I only want you to have this gift for the proper time."
"Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your kindness."
I put the box in my pocket. Pablo shook my hand with a brotherly firmness and looked directly into my eyes. "I feel a certain sadness about you. I think you have lost the ability to laugh innocently. You need to regain that ability. You've read Hesse's books, haven't you?"
"Yes, a long time ago."
"Then you should remember what I said to Harry Haller. The magic theater is for madmen only, and the price is only your mind. Do you admit to being a madman?" I laughed nervously. "Good," he said, and smiled brightly. "I'm glad to see you haven't forgotten completely how to laugh. I hope you'll enter this little theater and find much to marvel at. Also, remember that you'll be required to leave your personality, your ego, at the door. Good travels, my friend." On the train ride back to Amsterdam, I thought deeply about the strange things Pablo had said. Much had been on target. The book I'd brought with me, for example. It could be seen symbolically. The facts of the current journey I was on weren't unlike Malcolm Lowry's novel, Dark as the Grave Wherein My Friend Is Laid, with the main character Sigbjorn Wilderness taking his second wife along with him to Mexico to confront his past and search for his old friend and mentor Juan Fernando. I empathized greatly with Sigbjorn and with Lowry himself. There were many things we had in common. Lowry was, if nothing else, a symbolizer. Everything he thought, saw, experienced seemed to mean something dark and foreboding to him. The landscape of Mexico in both Dark as the Grave Wherein My Friend Is Laid and in his greatest work Under the Volcano is filled with abysses, labyrinths, and demons that represent his own personal hell, numbers and snippets of conversation overheard or combinations of words seen on a poster or menu represent various premonitions and omens. Throughout my own wandering life, I'd reacted to the stimuli around me in a similar fashion. The fictional version of my journey to the East was filled with symbolic descriptions of the landscape and, indeed, the character of Hassan, with whom I journeyed from Lorac to Iran, had become my own Virgil guiding me through a Dantesque inferno. And India, good God, India, the madness that overtook me by the time I was sleeping on the streets of Calcutta with the lepers and untouchables, had me seeing all sorts of strange visions and creatures from the netherworld. Yes, I had a strong connection to Lowry's madness. Alcoholism was there, too. I was a lightweight compared to Lowry's excesses, but I'd had my own battles with the booze, and no doubt that had exacerbated the hepatitis. I had an unquenchable thirst for beer, mainly, and the 6 months of abstinence I'd just completed while on the interferon was a constant battle. More to the point, though, I was a stoner, which is difficult in Japan because there's not a lot of pot to be found, not to mention the possibility of 7 years in the slammer with nothing but fish heads and rice if you're busted for possession. But in my 20s, I must have done a good 75 trips on one hallucinogen or another. Never had a bad trip either. Lowry was no pothead, but his choice of drink was mezcal, which can produce a hefty hallucinogenic experience. So there was that connection, too. What else? We were both expatriates. That in itself is the source of many strange neuroses and thought processes concerning one's identity, the meaning of life, the constant dealing with a foreign language, and no matter how proficient you become, there's always a nuance of misinterpretation to everything you say and hear, because no matter how you try, you can't escape totally from the culture you were raised in, the influences and values and judgments that marked you as a child and adolescent. You are, in a sense, doomed as a man without a home, an ibasho wa nai ningen, as they say in Japanese. Again, perhaps Pablo had been right. I was a self-exiled man, unable to integrate myself fully into society, destined to be the eternal outsider. We were also both ex-cons. I'd done my time, 6 months' worth, in a military brig as a conscientious objector refusing my order to fight in Nam in 1970. That single experience had catapulted me into the whole cauldron of mixed-up madness that comprised my life experiences and confusion of the following umpteen years, that is, until I met Kaori and somehow managed to bring it all under control. As for Lowry, he'd been arrested 3 times in Mexico during his first sojourn there. How he had suffered, such a story, such self-inflicted suffering. My own life, once I'd read Lowry's books and biography, seemed a breeze in the park, a mere comedy. But, as I say, we both knew what it was to be locked up, to be an undesirable in common society, to have, in Lowry's words, a Dostoevskian fixation on prison, practically a pathological sympathy for those who do wrong and get into the shit. These prison visions, no doubt for both of us, caused us to pour words on paper in a purging of the soul and a search for understanding. The result for Lowry was his masterpiece, Under the Volcano, for me, a minor novel that, if nothing else, proved therapeutic. There were more connections and similarities, but the main thing was that while reading Dark as the Grave Wherein My Friend Is Laid, I was finding on nearly every page some passage that described exactly what was happening or had happened to me. How could Pablo have known all that? Cowardy was still out when I got back to the hotel room. I pulled a chair up to the window overlooking the warm Straat, opened a beer, and watched the activity of the street below. I propped my right ankle up on a stool, sighed heavily, and thought again about my earlier days wandering through Europe. Those had been good days when my legs were strong and I could pace the streets for hours. Nostalgia came over me. I wished for a moment I was in my 20s again, walking and walking, driven by hunger and thought, ready to take any new road, to follow freely strange yearnings that would take me to all corners of the earth. Life had been poignant then, with all the multitudinous mysteries I'd faced head-on. Of course, there was comfort now in having a good job, some money, staying in a decent hotel, eating good food, not wanting for anything. But passion had left me, replaced by an inexplicable emptiness. It was hard to pinpoint exactly when my fatigue and apathy had set in. Certainly, when I arrived in Japan at the age of 32, I was still consumed by a vast store of energy and a thirst for more knowledge and more experience. Perhaps the years of adapting to a new culture had drained me. The living rough and broke for the first few years before the time came to make the decision to commit to the permanent life of an expatriate, knowing that in order to secure a more stable visa, job, and life, I'd need to gain the qualifications necessary to teach at a university. In my mid-30s, I began the correspondence course that eventually took 7 years to complete. Pure stubbornness it was to stick with it that long. But in the end, while working several part-time jobs, I'd gotten that master's degree, and all the efforts paid off when I landed a full-time job teaching at a women's junior college. Maybe those years of teaching too many hours at too many places, and working in every spare moment I could garner to complete the degree, this in addition to trying to learn the Japanese language, had burned me out. But I felt a tinge of pride in what I'd accomplished, in my perseverance, the one quality that through my life had allowed me to survive to the age of 49, an age I once thought distant, strange, somehow unattainable, and outlive my literary heroes, the ones who had burned themselves out too. Thomas Wolfe, dead at 37, Jack Kerouac, dead at 43, Malcolm Lowry, dead at 48. Not that I could count myself in their league, but if I died tomorrow, I could still say that I'd left behind something of a literary legacy. 2 novels, a novella used as a textbook in Japanese universities, 2 other reference books collaborated on with a group of Japanese authors, and 15 papers on teaching English as a foreign language. All in all, my work had had some merit. In rationalizing my life and accomplishments to myself, I could probably point to the time spent in the Denver military prison as the original spark that had motivated me all these years. Yes, I thought, if I ever had the chance, I'd dearly love to take my resume back to those psychiatrists, chaplains, officers, and others who had tried to break me down mentally and show me that the choice I'd made in refusing my order to fight in Nam would ruin my life, and that, as a coward and ex-con and communist, I'd never be able to hold a decent job, raise a family, maybe they'd been right there, or hold my head high as an upstanding citizen of the late, great United States of America, the greatest country in the history of mankind, the only country to truly have God on its side, and with the stigma of an undesirable discharge, an undesirable for Christ's sake, I'd be forced to live a life of shame if I didn't admit to my wrongdoing, adhere to the morals of society, and return to the fold as a rehabilitated man. Well, I'd prove them wrong. I had rejected their efforts to save me and created my own life, a good life, an independent life. But at what cost? Even though my stubbornness, my quirky independence, my drive, my obsessive nature, I supposed, had pushed me onto a path that held for me tenfold the experiences, discoveries, horrors, loneliness, and miles and countries covered in the lifetimes of most other men, there was still something missing. Perhaps that was the main reason for this trip. I thought of Thomas Knorr. Perhaps Thomas had the final answer for me. Hadn't Thomas, or at least the image of Thomas, always been a man who, from an early age, knew what his ideals and dreams were and pursued them? Hadn't Thomas been the personification of a man in tune with his time, a man with purpose to his life, a man of adventure who was not afraid to follow his dreams to their end in order to realize them? Perhaps it had simply been the intensity of the psilocybin we'd taken, or the quality of the hashish we'd smoked while discussing life and philosophy during our 10 days together back in 1977, but I believed I'd never connected intellectually as closely with anyone, except for Kaori, before or since. There had been an immediate and mutual understanding. Thomas hadn't questioned all the amazing coincidences he said had guided his life, the times when a second earlier or later here, or a couple of inches closer or farther apart there, had saved him, as if by a crazy kind of divine intervention. The strange appearance of benefactors of unknown origin, who either saved his ass in one way or led him in another before disappearing into the dust. It was in the unquestioning acceptance of whatever fate threw at him, as being right for the time, the free will of allowing himself simply to be carried off by the winds of the moment, the willful act of giving himself up to fate, accepting, knowing the path that lay ahead was already preordained and irrevocable. It was a faith, he had explained, that could not be articulated. In listening to Thomas, I had understood completely. During our time together, the unfathomable mysteries of my own life became clear, and I gained a vision of my future. My fears disappeared, and all the paths of the past that had led me to Thomas's house suddenly became meaningful as the inevitable ones I'd had to follow. It was an astonishing revelation. I had been born to be undesirable in order to free myself. Or so I'd thought back then. Anyway, what did it matter now? Shouldn't I be thinking about what to say to Thomas after not having any contact for 22 years? It was possible we'd both changed immeasurably since that time. If Thomas's situation was bad, as his wife Undine had said on the phone when I managed to contact her a couple of months before, would he even want to talk about the old days? What if he'd lost his faith in himself and the meaning of his life? What if he'd become a grumpy old man? Would he even want to see me? That was something I hadn't considered. What would Thomas think about my having used him as a character in my novel? Would he be angry, especially since I'd not even changed the name and place? If anyone else from Lorac read the parts in the book about his drug and smuggling experiences, would any harm come from it? And what about his appearance in my dream and the words he'd spoken? What did it mean? What was the symbolism there? I found myself rubbing the box Pablo had given me. I pulled it out of my pocket and opened it. There were 4 mushrooms, a tiny chessboard, and some figurines of different ages from infant to elderly inside. It was strange that Pablo knew so much about me, but like all the chance encounters with people I'd met throughout my life, I accepted it as natural. It had been that way with Thomas, with Hassan and Atola, with Kaori, with everyone who had influenced the direction of my life. I wasn't sure if I'd actually take the mushrooms or throw them away. Maybe I could take them just to get back into that hallucinogenic and revelatory frame of mind that had connected Thomas and me on the hill above his place where we'd walked after taking psilocybin and looked out on 3 countries and up at the stars 2 nights before I left with Hassan for Iran. Yes, that was an idea. After all, the last time I'd taken a hallucinogen was at least 20 years ago, when passion still burned within me and I felt deeply about everything in life. There was a knock on the door. I got up and opened it to find Kaori outside. We talked for a while about her discoveries and adventures after we got separated in Alkmaar. After she finished writing in her journal, we went out to dinner and decided to visit the Siberia again. I'd run out of the red bud and wanted to try something stronger. It was crowded, but we got a table to ourselves after I bought a gram of Siberian Tiger. I rolled a joint, took a good hit, and passed the joint to Kaori. "That other stuff we tried our first day here tasted nice, but I didn't feel anything," she said, and shrugged. "You have to hold it in your lungs longer. You only need a couple hits off this stuff. It's pretty strong." Kaori took 2 deep hits and gave the joint back to me. A little later, she looked at me strangely and said, "Honey-chan, I don't feel very good. I think I might have to throw up. My head is spinning." "It's probably the smoke and lack of fresh air in here. Too many people. Come on, let's go outside and get some fresh air." "I don't think I can stand up." "Here, I'll help you." I got up, helped Cowardy to her feet, and guided her outside. A cool breeze fanned our faces. Soft light from 2 street lamps danced on the canal, and the tree branches swayed. "Do you feel better?" I asked. "A little, but I don't like this feeling." A note of panic had crept into Cowardy's voice. "I think I'm losing control. I don't know if I can walk. What's happening to me?" "Don't worry, I'm here. I won't let anything happen to you. Here, take hold of my arm. I'll guide us back to the hotel. This is strong pot, but the intensity will go away soon enough. Trust me. Once we get back to our room, you'll feel safe and you can take a bath and lie down. Everything will be all right." Cowardy held on to me tightly until we made it back to our room. Her anxiety seemed to pass, and she took a long time in the bath. She lay down on the bed after that and soon fell asleep. I stayed up for a couple more hours and watched a Robin Williams movie on TV.